Major funding for The Pulse is provided by a leadership gift from the Sutherland Family Charitable Fund. The Sutherlands support WHYY and its commitment to the production of programs that improve our quality of life. Additional support for The Pulse is provided by AstraZeneca and Independence Blue Cross.
The OR is prepped, the patient is under, the nurses are standing by, but there is one thing missing, a soundtrack.
I do not like operating in silence. That is boring.
I'm Mike and Scott, and this is The Pulse, stories at the heart of health, science, and innovation.
Well, I was always fascinated by the brain.
I don't know what the hell's about to happen to me. This is going to be crazy.
The first day I start taking care of patients as a doctor.
To reveal, to find the brain systems of romantic love.
You recognize
love.
Big, round
you know, when you think
objects,
about it, a connected refrigerator isn't actually a horrible idea.
Taking a lighthearted look at whether it
existed.
I didn't see
that with your
the time when I'm healthy and I can almost hear the clock and I can feel like time's getting shorter.
On today's show, tourists traveling to African villages on a mental health mission, documenting your dad's dementia, and an ode to space exploration. But first up, scalpels, suction tubes, scopes. These are some of the instruments you'll find in an operating room. But when you, the patient, are out, many doctors take out another tool, music. As Alana Gordon reports, melodies play an important role in the OR. But what are surgeons listening to and who gets to pick? She takes us on this sonic journey to dissect some of the playlists.
Today happened to be a Jethro Tull day. From Aqualung to Thick as a Brick.
For Dr. Charles Yeo, amid all the sounds of the operating room, the heart monitors, IV drips, music is also a constant.
We listen to all sorts of great songs.
It's getting better all the time.
His unit at Thomas Jefferson University in Philadelphia usually prefers classic rock or straight-up country. The selection depends on their mood, or even the season.
Surfing is the only life, the only way for me now, surf.
When spring comes around,
surf.
We're hopeful, so we'll have a Beach Boys day.
Now, patients might be wondering, is this surgeon just having a beach party during a critical moment? Yeo says familiar, nostalgic music actually helps him do his job.
Does that have anything to do with operating on the pancreas? Of course not, but it brings me back to a time that I remember as a very carefree time, and therefore I think it takes the pressure off.
Music in the operating room is kind of a thing. Yeo recalls when he started in the 70s, ORs had it, even though hospitals banned radios.
But we used to sneak them in anyway.
Technology has come a long way since those little transistor radios.
They used to bring their little boom boxes, and we listened to it.
Krista Bonifante is a nurse at Hahnemann Hospital.
Now they have iPods with their little iPod speakers, so things have evolved.
Not all doctors listen to music, but I reached out to several hospitals and got lots of responses. Hahnemann alone is a cacophony of melodies, depending on the surgeon and the team.
Some days we'll listen to Elvis, some days we'll listen to Rod Stewart.
I usually play a mixture of rock, punk.
That is Dr. Scott Land. Lauren Charles is another nurse.
Usually I'll take a survey of the room before. We listen to a lot of Pandora here.
Classical.
Johnny Cash puts me over the edge, and I'm like, we're really not going to listen to Johnny Cash today, are we?
Also Paul Simon.
That's Dr. Julia Spears. If the patient's awake, it's always their choice. Some research suggests music can create a calming effect. Certain ORs have rituals.
Wednesday is usually some type of jazz.
And Friday?
Start spreading the news.
Everyone scrubs in.
New York, New York.
And it's Frank Sinatra all day long.
If I can.
These can be long operations.
The music keeps us going. It puts us in a good mood.
It's a
up to you.
At times, there can be a discordance in taste.
Dr. Mitra, his music is it's questionable. Yesterday, I was tortured by his opera music. It was bearable. It was bearable.
My music would be pretty slow music.
Dr. Amitrabha Mitra is a plastic surgeon at Hahnemann. Again, Boninfante.
He'll just sit there and like he meditates a little bit. He gets real quiet and he listens to it, and then he'll go out and scrub into surgery.
Because in microsurgery, if you're agitated, you get a little bit of a tremor. If you're calmed down, you don't get a tremor. And you can stitch the arteries and microscopic stuff pretty easily.
The selection also depends on what's happening in the surgery.
For example, if I'm doing a breast reconstruction, for example, at the end of the operation, it's about an hour, hour and a half worth of stitching. It's essentially walking a mile. So in those cases, we can put any music and do it because it's a routine step.
No matter how much a doctor might like it, some music is never appropriate for an operating room.
Don't play things like Another One Bites the Dust by Queen.
Another one bites the dust.
Dr. David Bosanquet is a surgical resident in South Wales. He recently put together a fun essay and OR playlist for the British Medical Journal. He has some alternate suggestions.
Staying Alive by the Bee Gees, that's always a good one.
His preference.
Fix You by Coldplay.
Bad puns aside, Bosanquet wanted to know more about this trend he kept finding in the OR. Turns out, music has struck a chord in medicine for centuries. 100 years ago, the well-known surgeon Evan Kane wrote a brief for the Journal of the American Medical Association, specifically on the, quote, calming and positive properties of the phonograph for both the patient and surgeon.
So it's interesting to see this pioneer linking music and the beneficial effects in the operating room.
Kane's big claim to fame was taking out his own appendix while listening to music. Bosanquet says literature suggests that nowadays up to 70% of surgeons listen to something. He points to the limited evidence, mostly surveys and observational studies, that finds that music can be advantageous.
To aid concentration and keep everybody focused.
Not everyone agrees.
If it's a very complicated operation, for example, then there is an issue that it drowns out the senses and can actually reduce performance.
So, helpful music for some, maybe a detractor for others.
And I think it's partly to do with how brains are wired.
Dr. Scott Levin is chair of orthopedic surgery at the University of Pennsylvania.
So when I listen to music in the operating room, particularly Julian Bream or John Williams playing the guitar, they're absolute perfectionists, and what I hear is perfect music. And so perhaps subconsciously I say, the surgical detail or the part of the surgery that I'm performing needs to be commensurate with that degree of perfection and excellence that allows me to do my surgery better.
Again, David Bosanquet.
I have heard anecdotal evidence of, you know, hard metal being played in theatre. And I can only imagine finding that hugely distracting.
My favorite band is probably Metallica.
Dr. Timothy Schmidt is a surgeon at one of the biggest transplant centers in the country, in Kansas City.
You know, I would find classical music distracting. Country music is really not appropriate for the OR.
Of course, he's a heavy metal guy. So is his surgical tech, Christopher Washington.
I think transplant team is a different breed. It's perfect for us. It calms us down.
Doing liver transplant and big cancer cases, we have to be aggressive sometimes and decisive when we do the things we do in the operating room, so it kind of suits our personality.
Washington says the OR is not some Danzig or Tool concert. There's no mosh pit. The music is just audible, so everyone can be attuned to the important stuff. And even though musical tastes may clash from one OR to the next, there does appear to be a harmonious agreement on this. If the operation becomes really complicated, if it takes an unexpected turn, the soundtrack becomes silence.
If things get a little too out of hand, we know how to turn them off.
If you notice that things are getting a little intense, we can turn off the music.
Except that time, we may ask people just to be quiet completely.
But when they're in the clear again, the music comes back on. For The Pulse, I'm Alana Gordon.
One of the surgeons Alana interviewed has especially refined tastes when it comes to his OR playlist, and you can hear what he told Alana when you sign up for our newsletter at whyy.org/pulse-newsletter. Pluto has been getting serious social media love all week. Starting Wednesday afternoon Eastern Time, the New Horizons spacecraft has been beaming back close-up photos of the dwarf planet. The images captured young ice mountains with peaks as high as 11,000 feet. Joining us now to talk more about what we're learning from these images is MIT Professor Richard Binzel. He's a member of the Mission Science team. Richard, thank you so much for being here.
It's great to be here.
Are these images everything you had hoped for, you had dreamed of? You've been waiting for a long time to get them.
We've been waiting more than 9 years, and they are beyond expectation.
So what are we learning by looking at the images we have so far?
Well, we're learning that Pluto is not a dead, cold world. It is an active world. It's hard to believe or hard to understand that there can be so much going on a little planet that's 3 billion miles from the sun.
What is going on? What are some things you're seeing?
Well, we see ice sheets, and we see bright regions, dark regions, and you have to have seasons or something going on to keep something bright because space is a dirty place with all the impacts that occur. We see those mountains sticking up. We don't know if they're made of water or made of frozen nitrogen. It's really hard to expect or imagine how you can build mountains on a little tiny planet.
What do the mountains mean?
Yeah, what do they mean? That's a great question. To make mountains, something has to be pushing something up. And we just don't know what it is that's doing that kind of activity on Pluto.
Could there be life on Pluto?
Certainly not life as we know it, or as we're used to, but we do find life in some very extreme environments on Earth, whether it's deep in Antarctica, ice cores, or even hot springs like in Yellowstone.
How much can we deduce from these pictures? What is the limitation of having just quote-unquote images?
We are going to learn an awful lot about Pluto from these images because we have this sequence. All the instruments and the exact images we're taking, the ones we're going to download over the next year, have been so carefully planned out to maximize the information. So one can always learn more, but we know we are going to be challenged for years ahead trying to decode what this all means.
Will you know, for example, what the temperature there is, those kinds of things?
In fact, yeah, we do have temperature measurements. We know they were successfully made. Well, it's below a minus 100 Kelvin, and that's, I think, minus 280 Fahrenheit.
Pretty cold.
as we say in Boston, it's wicked cold on Pluto.
So these images will continue to come for the next 16 months, right?
That's right. You can think of this process as the longest download in history. We'll never complain again about how long it takes to download an HD movie. The reason for the slow download is our recorders are just chock full of megabytes, in fact, gigabytes of data. and we can only stream it back at about 1 kilobit per second. So this means it's just a long, slow process, but we want to get every bit of data back down off that spacecraft.
And where will the New Horizons mission go next now? What's next?
So we have passed Pluto, and Newton's laws of motion say that once in motion, we will stay in motion. The spacecraft will ultimately leave the solar system, but before we do, we've identified several potential objects in the Kuiper Belt, this new zone of asteroids that exists beyond Neptune. That's something new in the last 10 to 20 years. And we'll be hoping to be able to pass by one or more of them. We'll need some approval from NASA to extend the mission, but our voyage of exploration will in fact go on.
Can the information you're getting back, could that potentially change Pluto's status?
Well, we always think of it as a planetary world, and we don't care too much about the label. It's a dwarf planet. The sun is a dwarf star, so we think of dwarf planets as planets with all equal standing, no matter what you call it.
And finally, you've dedicated so much of your time, of your passion and energy to Pluto. Why? What's your fascination with it? Why is this so important?
Well, planets have always held a captivation for me since I saw Saturn's rings through a telescope when I was 12 years old. And so I think it's just the idea that these are reachable worlds where you can formulate ideas with telescopes on Earth and then ultimately go there and resolve those questions you once had and then formulate new questions based on the amazing things that you see up close.
Richard, thank you so much for talking with me.
My pleasure.
Richard Binzel is an MIT professor and a member of the science team for the New Horizons mission. Of course, we've been following the Twitter hashtag PlutoFlyby all week, and there's a lot of great content out there. One of the things we came across was a video of the late great science fiction writer Ray Bradbury reading his poem, If Only We Had Taller Been. And he hits on some of the same issues that Richard just mentioned in our interview, the reason why humanity is intrigued by space travel. He read this poem in November of 1971, just after NASA's unmanned space program Mariner 9 had successfully reached Mars. Let's take a listen.
I'll read it to you. It's very, very short. The fence we whacked between the years did balance us serene. It was a place half in the sky where in the green of leaf and promising of peach, we'd reach our hand to touch and almost touch the sky. If we could reach and touch, we said, 'twould teach us not to, never to, be dead. We ached and almost touched that stuff. Our reach was never quite enough. If only we had taller been and touched God's cuff, his hem, we would not have to go with them who've gone before, who, short as us, stood tall as they could stand and hoped by stretching tall that they might keep their land, their home, their hearth, their flesh and soul. But they, like us, were standing in a hole. Oh, Thomas, will a race one day stand really tall across the void, across the universe and all, and measured out with rocket fire, at last put Adam's finger forth as on the Sistine ceiling, and God's hand come down the other way to measure man and find him good and gift him with forever's day? I work for that. Short man, large dream. I send my rockets forth between my ears, hoping an inch of good is worth a pound of years, aching to hear a voice cry back along the universal mall, we've reached Alpha Centauri. We're tall. Oh, God, we're tall.
Science fiction writer Ray Bradbury reading his poem, If Only We Had Taller Been. This is from 1971. Coming up, this sounds like a bad idea, right? Tourists taking trips to find out what it's like to have a mental illness.
They've seen a lot, they heard a lot, they've been in a very stressful time, and I like to see how they cope with it.
But these tourist visits are helping to change attitudes around mental health issues in Rwanda. Still to come on The Pulse here on WHYY.
Independence Blue Cross supports WHYY's The Pulse and strives to lead the way with a focus on preventing illness rather than reacting to it. That's why they're proud to offer health programs, including fitness reimbursements and health coaches, to help keep you healthy. And it's why they're proud to sponsor programs and events around the city like the Blue Cross Broad Street Run and Indigo, Philadelphia's first bike share program. More at IBX.com and RideIndigo.com. Independence Blue Cross. Live fearless.
Supporting WHYY's The Pulse, AstraZeneca, offering resources to help patients afford and access their medicines. The AZ and Me patient assistance programs provided more than 382,000 patients in the U.S. with more than $670 million in savings in 2014. AstraZeneca Direct offers a range of patient support services, including delivery of brand-name prescription medications directly to a person's home. More at AstraZeneca-US.com.
This is The Pulse, stories at the heart of health, science, and innovation. I'm Maiken Scott. Our next story takes us to Rwanda, and it's probably going to sound a little bit unusual or even unorthodox, but it is a way to address a serious problem in a country with very limited resources. Rates of mental illness in Rwanda are significantly higher than in other countries. This is largely attributed to the trauma many suffered during the 1994 genocide, which left nearly 1 million dead and a country full of people deeply affected emotionally. The government is trying to respond to the need for mental health care, but accessing treatment is difficult. For example, there are only 6 psychiatrists in the entire country. Another issue is the fierce stigma that surrounds mental illness in Rwanda. There's an organization that is trying to address these attitudes in surprising ways. Wyatt Orm reports.
Is this your first time in Rwanda?
It's my first time in Africa. So also in Rwanda, yes.
Yeah. Irena Homfeld doesn't know it yet, but she's about to spend her day fighting stigma. She's been in Rwanda for 2 months and returns to Holland in a few days. Before leaving, she's scheduled what's called a culture tour. Homfeld paid the fee of roughly $35 and dressed in comfortable clothes. She's being driven a little outside the country's capital city, Kigali. Her hosts for the day are a group of villagers with mental illness. She works as a speech therapist back in Holland, so maybe her being a trained care provider explains some of the interest. She's also very curious about the psychology of people who've witnessed genocide.
They've seen a lot, they heard a lot, they've been in a very stressful time, and I like to see how they cope with it.
We are here.
Ah, good.
Homfeld and her translator have arrived in the village of Chininya. The car parks before a row of houses spaced evenly along a dirt road. They look tidy, with gray facades and tin roofs. The group of villagers is actually just 2 women, Marika Tete Shemsa and Umutoni Wase Divine, known as Mutoni. Shemsa ties a traditional kitenge skirt over Homfeld's blue jeans. It's long and has a colorful pattern. The 3 sit down for tea in Mutoni's home and begin to tell their stories with the help of translator Jackie Namara.
I had mental illness or psychosocial disability. I was on medication for 7 years.
Shemsa's entire family was killed during the genocide. She was an orphan at age 9. Her mental health issues started, she says, when the woman who took her in started mistreating her.
Before I saw myself and I said I have no value and my life is just a mess, I will not amount to anything.
Both Mutoni and Shemsa are part of Twizirane. It's one of 14 peer support groups operating under the umbrella of NUSPER, the organization that runs the culture tours.
NUSPER. National Organization of Users and Survivors of Psychiatry in Rwanda.
Sam Badege is the organization's executive director. He's a lawyer and a disability rights advocate. He experienced trauma in 1994 and has felt firsthand the very stigma he's fighting. NUSPER advocates for people with mental illnesses, or psychosocial disabilities, as Badege calls them.
Schizophrenia, bipolar disorder, autism, all those people are here.
The organization provides a network of support for its 1,200 members across Rwanda. Most of the 14 groups meet weekly, which helps break the terrible isolation they often face. But Dege says people with mental illnesses are often shunned by their families. They're not invited to events like weddings, they can't find work, and in some cases, it's worse. For example, The organization recently took in a young woman with autism who'd run away from home.
And when we brought her here, we stayed with her for, I think, 10 days only. And we had discovered a lot of her problems. And much of the problems were actually not because of the illness. It was the attitude of the people around her.
For years, her family had beaten and harassed her. The stress became unbearable. When Nusper found her, she'd been wandering for 3 months. They helped clean her up, gave her new clothes, and took her home.
When she came, they said, hey, this can't be possible. How can a mad person look like this? This is marvelous. We have never seen this before.
One of the organization's patient experts began visiting the family every week. They taught the young woman basic life skills like brushing teeth and trimming fingernails. Nusper's patient experts are usually people who have had similar struggles in their past. Badege says creating better lives for people with mental illnesses starts with reducing stigma. For that to happen, people need a voice.
I'm here. See me. Live with me. Talk to me. Reason with me. I'm also a person first. I'm a Rwandan like you.
This is where the culture tours come in. So back to Dutch tourist Irene Homfeld as she tries her hand at harvesting beans.
All the way. Okay, and then you do this. But where are the beans then?
There.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
The Katenge skirt falls down.
Oh. My skirt. It's not working on my hips.
She goes to help fetch water.
Okay. Try again.
She helps cook.
Well, I've never been recorded. I'm slicing potatoes.
She asks questions and exchanges stories with Mutoni.
He was not killed in the genocide.
Oh.
Yeah, he fell sick.
Oh.
And after 1 week, he died.
Oh.
And then the genocide happened after he had died.
My father also died when I was 14.
Mutoni explains that the culture tours and the presence of white people, or Omuzungus, in her community have changed how people in her village treat her.
They say, the family of Mutoni had visitors and they were whites, and now she can even host whites. So,
okay.
So it changes.
It gives them kind of status.
Yes.
Not all of Nusper's groups have access to culture tourists like Homfeld. The groups closer to Kigali mostly benefit from this program. But the organization is growing fast, and culture tours farther afield are in the future. As for Homfeld, she enjoyed the day. Any fight against stigma is a worthy one. However, the fact that she brought prestige to her hosts by virtue of being white felt a little unsettling.
I think white people can start something, but I think it's better when the Rwandese people take over. Yeah. So otherwise it feels a little colonial. It feels like, oh, we know the best and we help you.
Sam Badege is proud of the culture tours. He says they work well and he's optimistic about the future. He says the days of extreme isolation are numbered for people with mental illness in Rwanda.
That's okay. Those were the dark days. And now we are coming to the world of reality. We are seeing the light.
For The Pulse, I'm Wyatt Orne.
Funding for this story was provided by the Scattergood Foundation as part of its multimedia mental health journalism series. You're listening to The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott. Being diagnosed with Alzheimer's disease is devastating. Some have terrible anxiety knowing they will lose parts or all of their memory. And for family members, it's difficult to watch a loved one's life shrink. Ellie Brown is a photographer in South Philadelphia who began documenting this journey when her father started showing signs of dementia. She sent us this essay.
In the winter of 2015, my father was officially diagnosed with early onset Alzheimer's after years of ambiguous dementia symptoms. The diagnosis was not a surprise, but devastating nonetheless. A lot of the problems my father faces with his memory are due to anxiety about forgetting. He once told me that living with early onset Alzheimer's means always looking over my shoulder like there is something I should be afraid of and not knowing exactly what it is. Mostly he's just really annoyed by it.
Hey, Dad.
Hello, Ellie. How are you?
I'm good. How are you today?
I'm just fine, thanks.
When my father started showing signs of dementia, I started taking notes on our conversations, spending more time taking pictures of him, and recording conversations about his condition.
I think it's scary. For you, what's the scariest part?
I think the scariest part really is the effect that it'll have on my family. I mean, I hate to say it, but at some point there's going to be a point where I will not be as situationally aware as I may be now. And there are times already when Jane has had to help me with things. That's the scariest part and the one that, I fear the most.
Jane is my stepmother. Among many things, he depends on her for memory assistance. Things like, where is it? What is it? Where do I take the dog to get groomed? She recently took a trip to Puerto Rico and Dad stayed home. She arranged for people to stop by to feed him or to take him out for meals. He joked that she was worried he'd forget to eat. He jokes about it a lot. My father drives around town in a limited radius. This includes the grocery store, library, and Dunkin' Donuts. He feels anxious about driving into the next town or getting on the highway. He has OnStar in his car for directions and auto assistance, but it seems like the act of driving itself causes anxiety. Winston the dog gets walked twice a day. This is the least stressful part of my father's daily routine. He knows the mile-and-a-half route well and has even been branching out to try new alternate routes to test whether or not he will get lost. Even if he does get lost, the dog has a GPS chip implanted in his back.
I want to go back to talking about technology. You now have things available to you that 20 years ago someone in the same position wouldn't have had available to them.
Mm-hmm. I mean, to put it simply, the technology that I had put together, and it's really not rocket science, it's via an iPhone, where I store my brain. You know, the simple things like to-dos and whatever, but more and more, I have to have a data bank or a listing, if you will, of people that I've met and who they are and who they are in my life. Not you, Ellie, but people that I meet, in meetings or I meet at Temple or wherever, and that's a very very big piece of it.
Singing is one of the things that my father enjoys most in life. He sings in the temple choir frequently. The temple cantor asked him to sing with a group called the Tremble Clefs. It's an ensemble of people with Parkinson's disease. My father does not have Parkinson's, but he is a great baritone, and the cantor told him that his voice would serve as a reference for the Parkinson's patients who have trouble with their voices. For most of his life, my father has been doing musical theater. He recently tried to participate in a production of The Music Man through the temple, but couldn't remember the blocking, so he had to drop out. He does not remember how to read music, but he can still learn new music through listening and repeating.
I think that in a situation like this, the feelings are going to be very intense. And as the process of my disease progresses, it's not going to get prettier. And so we've got to be prepared for that.
But I have to say, you can intellectually prepare for something, but I don't think you can ever emotionally prepare for this.
Well, you can't. I thought, given everything that I've been through already, would have prepared me for the new latest news. And it sure did not. I had to cry. I mean, I cried. And I know I'm not the only one. And that release of the emotion is just what the first step in the family coming to grips with what it means.
The amazing thing about my father is that he's more worried about the impact his disease will have on the family than himself. When I visit home, I feel like I'm always sitting on the edge of my seat, watching his every move like an overprotective parent. It's devastating to talk to my father every week and to notice the slight changes. He's the closest person to me in the world, and he is falling away a small piece at a time.
In our life, we all have to be ready to take on whatever we are handed and deal with it.
I love you, Dad.
I love you, too.
Thank you.
Ellie Brown is a Philadelphia photographer documenting her father's life with dementia, and you can see her photos on our website at whyy.org/thepulse. Peter Crimmins produced this piece. Coming up, could a simple technique avoid major health complications down the road?
There's the red light. That means breathe. That was excellent.
Still to come on The Pulse here on WHYY.
Actively supporting nonprofit organizations that increase disease awareness, prevention, and access to medicines in the Philadelphia region, AstraZeneca supports WHYY's The Pulse. Learn more by visiting AstraZeneca-US.com.
Independence Blue Cross supports WHYY's The Pulse and strives to lead the way with a focus on preventing illness rather than reacting to it. They are proud to offer health programs, including fitness reimbursements and health coaches. IBX.com. Independence Blue Cross. Live fearless.
This is The Pulse, stories at the heart of health, science, and innovation. I'm Mike and Scott. Cancer treatment is tough on the body. In recent years, as care has improved and the technology has advanced, doctors are looking for ways to limit the harsh side effects of therapy. For breast cancer, one technique is surprisingly simple. Tanya English reports.
Radiation therapy uses high-energy X-ray beams to shrink tumors. The big challenge is to treat the disease, all while keeping healthy body parts out of the line of fire. But living, breathing patients are a moving target.
This February, there was a reoccurrence in the same breast. It was actually in the chest wall.
That's Shannon McMahon. This is her second battle with breast cancer. McMahon had chemotherapy earlier this year at the University of Pennsylvania. Now, radiation is her best chance to clear away any microscopic cancer cells that may be left behind. But first, she's learning how to hold her breath.
You see the prongs here? Mm-hmm. You're going to kind of bite onto them. You don't have to chomp hard.
Therapist Katie Chong settles McMahon flat on her back. A mouthpiece, kind of like a snorkel, keeps McMahon from talking, but she can breathe just fine.
Okay, now I'm going to put on the nose clip. Mm-hmm. You let me know if it's sliding or if you're able to breathe out of your nose. Good?
Mm-hmm. The whole contraption is rigged up to a computer that charts each breath in and each breath out.
I don't want her going like, or going like, this is just sitting on the couch Friday night watching TV with the hubby, mm-hmm. not doing anything, not thinking about anything, just breathing.
30 or 40 years ago, radiation technology was less precise. Doctors discovered that too many of their patients were dying not from cancer, but from heart disease caused by the radiation itself.
So any survival benefit from the radiation was lost.
Radiation oncologist Ronnie Anae cares for patients at Jefferson University Hospital. In her work, millimeters matter. So with each new case, she uses a computer and 3D images to map the inside of her patient's body. The goal is to deliver a full dose of treatment to the right places. It can help to place a patient on her stomach and let gravity move the breast away from vital organs. But Jefferson's studies show that with the breath hold maneuver, the dose of radiation that hits the heart is cut to nearly zero.
So when you take a breath, think about the fact that your chest expands. As it expands, the lungs inflate. As they become bigger, the space between the breast and the heart increases.
Radiation can scar and stiffen the arteries and the lining of the heart, but trouble typically takes 10 or 15 years to show up. That kind of long-term side effect is a concern even more these days because cancer survival is so much better now.
Breast cancer is extremely curable, so our patients are going to live a long time.
And they're going to need a healthy heart later in life. Shannon McMahon and other women who have breast cancer on the left side have a greater risk of developing cardiac problems from radiation. So now many specialty cancer centers teach some version of coordinated breathing.
Okay. When you see the green light appear, I want you to inhale into the line and hold your breath. Okay. So there's the green. So go ahead, up, 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 up. And hold. Right there. Perfect. Right now we're holding for 30 seconds, okay? When we are finished holding for 30 seconds, I'm going to give you the red light. When you see the red light, that means that you can breathe again. So hang on for another 15 seconds. There's the red light. That means breathe. That was excellent.
During an actual treatment session, the patient only has to hold her breath 4 to 8 times. If a bit of air slips out, a soft buzzer alerts the therapist to shut the machine down. Shannon McMahon got the hang of it with about 20 minutes of practice.
Definitely a little awkward at first, but after the third time, it worked a little bit better.
When Jefferson researchers studied the breath hold maneuver, on average, the amount of scatter radiation that reached the heart was reduced by 63%.
That's good. So what that means is almost everybody benefited from the technique.
Researchers have been following women for 5 years. That's not enough time to know for sure that breath hold prevents long-term cardiac problems. But Ronnie Anae says now she knows how to better protect a patient's heart. For The Pulse, I'm Tanya English.
You're listening to The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott. Mindy Keefe wanted to be an artist, but she wasn't quite sure if she was good enough. Instead, she became a chemist who is passionate about paints. She works for Dow Chemical and has forged relationships with the art restoration community to help restore modern paintings. For our series, So What Do You Do? Down-to-Earth Conversations about Research and Science, Mindy sat down with Millersville University art historian Christine Philippone. Christine asked Mindy,
so what do you do?
I am a research scientist at Dow Chemical, and I make paint. And what I was interested in was that intersection between what I was doing in my day job and the science of improving coatings and paints and the science of paints in artwork. Mm. When you think about it, the painting, whether it's on your wall or whether it's on a canvas, it really is the same technology, and it has a lot of the same challenges.
Mm, right.
And I think it's really because I like paint, and I like to paint myself. I paint in acrylics. You know, if I was going to do science, I liked doing science in that space.
I see. So you still paint?
Well, not as much since I have my children. So now with my children, I do more like, you know, crayons and
right,
watercolor.
Finger paint, right.
Finger paints, exactly. But my, yeah.
With special insights into that finger paint, I'm sure.
There you go.
So I understand that you became very involved in a particular and very famous project, the cleaning of a painting by the abstract expressionist artist Mark Rothko, which had been marked with graffiti some years ago. It's at the Tate in London. So can you talk a little bit about that project?
One of the challenges that's incredibly daunting about the field of art conservation is every piece of artwork is different. Each one is made up of its own mixture of types of raw materials. It's all had its own history in terms of what it's been exposed to, its age, mm-hmm. et cetera. Mm-hmm. So each piece is unique, right? And so there is going to be no one perfect solution, right, for every acrylic painting, for example. So we have been taking a toolbox approach, and that we try to come up with options that are very flexible. Mm-hmm. So here's a whole new class of materials. I don't think any one of these is perfect, mm-hmm. but we feel like one of these many options might be well-suited for your need.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the part of the training and the thought processes we're trying to work with conservators. You don't want to do anything that would harm the appearance, obviously, and the physical integrity. Just so if you think about your wall, that whole freshly painted look,
uh-huh.
it just doesn't last forever, right? You paint your room and it gets scuff marks or burnish or change in gloss or, heaven forbid, pets and kids,
uh-huh.
right? And so it's really hard to clean it and keep the same appearance.
Mm-hmm.
Well, acrylic paintings are very much the same. Mm-hmm. So if you have a cleaning solution but it changes the color or the gloss, those are
And that can be so controversial because these artworks are so valuable. And there have been very famous controversies. Maybe the most famous is Michelangelo's Sistine Ceiling.
Yep.
Right? Which totally changed the look of the frescoes.
Exactly. And so every conservator, I mean, I'm not a conservator, so I can just speak for kind of looking from the outside in. They are a very conservative field in general, right? And for good reason. That being said, things get dirtied and soiled and mm-hmm, harmed, and
right.
in many cases there needs to be treatments.
Right?
And so we're basically trying to come up with what's this. This is everything we know about these paintings. and what are the safest approaches to removing, for example, that soil without harming the original appearance or the painting itself.
Right.
The Rothko was a separate example. So in this case, there was a specific soil, right? It was the graffiti ink that the person had used in vandalizing the paintings. So we did quite a bit of analysis with we have a solvents business at Dow, which we have some proprietary software that allows us to really analyze the properties of the ink. And then using the software, we can predict which solvents would be most soluble in that ink. Mm-hmm. And so we went through hundreds and hundreds of different solvent options to understand what would be most soluble in the ink. And then we came basically with a list of 16 that we thought were good candidates, and we had like a top five list.
And the Rothko painting was a special challenge because Mark Rothko paints layer upon layer, thin layer of oil paint upon thin layer, and introduces other materials. So that poses a whole host of other problems.
Exactly. And the painting itself, this one was called, unofficially called, untitled, but called Black on Maroon.
Mm-hmm.
The black area had several glazes on it that really helped to prevent the ink from penetrating in. But unfortunately, the maroon sections of the painting did not have those glazes, so the ink really went right through the canvas.
Uh-huh. Do you have any questions for me?
So you're kind of on the other side, right? So you're an art historian, right? So you see different types of modern art coming through.
Oh, sure.
It's always interesting to me now having seen this side, right? You think, wow, all these amazing new materials and new effects. And sometimes I feel like maybe artists don't appreciate what it is essentially they're doing for the art conservation field.
You mean to make conservators' lives more difficult?
Exactly. I don't know.
Well, there are works of art that are comprised of edible materials. I mean, the sculptor Janine Antoni makes artwork out of chocolate and Crisco sort of materials. You know, they're in the collections of art museums, and those poor people in the conservation labs at those museums, right? They definitely have a difficult task in front of them. And this work is very valuable. So it's definitely in the interest of the museum, and it's in the interest of the artist to have this attended to. So, no, it's absolutely critically important to the field. Well, thank you so much, Mindy. Thank you so much for coming down and talking to us about your work. We really appreciate it.
And thank you for your time.
Mindy Keefe is a scientist specializing in paints and coatings at Dow Chemical. She spoke with Millersville University art historian Christine Philippone for our series, So What Do You Do? And this disclosure, Dow Chemical provides funding to WHYY. Finally on today's show, a controversy is sweeping the nation, and we think science can help set the record straight. I'm talking, of course, about the Minion toys that are currently included in McDonald's Happy Meals for kids, and some parents are not happy about what they think one of them says. Let's take a listen. Jayatri Das is here. She is chief bioscientist for the Franklin Institute in Philadelphia. And Jayatri, what did you think the toy says?
So the funny thing is, this is the first time I'm hearing just the sound by itself. And to me, it really doesn't sound like anything.
Right. It just sounds like gibberish, which is Minionese is the language that the Minion toy speaks.
Right.
But there are some people who say the toy says, what the blank. Let's hear it again. So when you go into it thinking the toy says what the you actually do hear it, right? So what is the brain process that makes that happen?
So first, once you hear the sound as it's associated with a face, that's when you start to perceive it as language, because we assume that sounds coming from a face mean something. So now your brain wants to assign meaning to it, even though it's very ambiguous. So what does your brain do? It pulls on your past experience to try to assign meaning to something that doesn't make any sense. And you listen to those three fast syllables with a somewhat flat affect. And if expressing frustration with those words is part of your vocabulary, that tone brings back that experience, and that's what you perceive.
So our brains are always drawing on previous information.
Absolutely. You're always trying to create meaning for new information by attaching it to something that already means something to you.
And if I go into it and somebody else has already told me this toy says what the blank, I'm going to hear it.
Exactly, because that's now part of your past experience as well.
So it's all in our heads.
It is all in your head. It probably says more about you than it does about the toy.
Jayatri Das is chief bioscientist for the Franklin Institute in Philadelphia. Thank you so much for being here.
Thanks for having me.
All right, now that that's settled, we can wrap up today's show. The Pulse is a production of WHYY in Philadelphia. Our health and science reporters are Tanya English, Carolyn Beeler, Alana Gordon, and Todd Bookman. We had engineering help this week from Al Banks and Adam Staniszewski, while Charlie Kyer is cattle ranching in Wyoming or something along those lines. Joel Patterson is our managing editor, Megan Pinto, our executive producer. Chris Atulo is vice president of news, and Christine Dempsey, our chief content officer. Did you miss some of this show or any of our previous shows? Subscribe to our podcast. It's on iTunes, or you can find it on our website at whyy.org/thepulse. That's also where you can get in touch with us. Send us an email with your questions, your feedback, your ideas. We always love to hear from you. I'm Mike and Scott. Thank you for listening.